Well, yes, it is. Hi, everybody. Coming up in a moment, Bart Costco. What an incredible guy, professor of electrical engineering at the University of Southern California. He holds degrees in philosophy, economics, mathematics, and electrical engineering, and now law. Dr. Costco recently became a licensed California attorney after passing the bar exam on the first shot. Hardly anybody ever does that, and working for the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office. He is an elected governor of the International Neural Network Society, has chaired several international conferences on neural and fuzzy systems conferences, sits on the electoral board of several scientific and mathematical journals, has published well over 100 scientific papers, and has published several popular essays in venues from Scientific American to the New York Times, and in fact is a frequent contributor to the opinion pages of the Los Angeles Times. Now, he has written a book, just written a book, about noise. Actually, it's called Noise. And, of course, Heaven in the Chip, even Heaven in a Chip, you recall that. But noise is a very, very, very interesting topic. And in a moment, we'll make some of it. Bart Costco, welcome back to Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, Art. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you,
happy
indeed.
Father's Day.
And Father's Day, yes, yes. Every few years, Father's Day rolls around on June 17th, Sunday, as the day I was born, and this is one of those. Anyway, it's great to have you back, and very interesting topic, noise. I lived, as you know, for 8 months in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Philippines, Bart, noise is part of the culture. And I mean very seriously so. Every little store has speakers out blasting at ear-splitting levels. I mean, it's just part of the culture. And when I brought Erin to America, the first thing that hit her, as the noise hit me when I got there, was the amazing, by contrast, silence. It was bothersome, actually.
Well, enjoy it while it lasts, Art, because I think you've got a taste of things to come. Those stereo systems are becoming more frequent, more powerful, and it's not going to go in the other direction.
What made you even decide to look into the subject of noise?
That's a good question. It's a natural follow-on to fuzz. It's looking at one of those garbage bin technologies that scientists and engineers have, I think, treated the wrong way, and often in the past. There's been a long-standing war on noise. And the other reason, Art, is in the course of researching fuzzy systems and especially neural networks, how brains work, how neurons work, a lot of us kept finding in the early to mid-80s that a little bit of noise helped the system. That was really an intriguing process. And meanwhile, while teaching at USC and places like that, I and others did the usual routine of how do we fight noise, how do we filter it, cancel it, which is an important thing to do. But there was a sense that we hadn't done enough of it. Another way to think about it is that so much of our mathematical view of the world is linear. And to compensate for the fact that we've got a nonlinear world, we add a noise term. And that really means the real structure of the world is in that noise term, at least in the way we model it. And so over the years, increasing work until I finally was able to make a contribution, and contrary to expectation, find that in some important cases, noise really helped, all the way down to the nanotechnology level. But the other reason, Art, is I hate noise.
I do, too. And what I was about to say is I go into a restaurant, for example, and it is so annoying. Noise starts, and you can have a large group of people, and it's relatively quiet, or like a group of, mindless sheep, it starts getting louder and louder and louder and louder, and the louder it gets, because nobody can hear the person across from them, across the table from them.
Exactly.
And so they start talking louder, and pretty soon it's unbearable.
In fact, I call that the restaurant effect. It's like the cocktail party effect when several people are talking and trying to pick out the voice in the background. The restaurant effect, just as you described it, is such that if you and I are talking, as we now are, we have an average signal-to-noise ratio between us. And as the ambient background noise increases, we have to speak louder to maintain that same ratio. But as we do that, we contribute to this collective failure of raising the overall noise level for everybody else, who then they have to respond by raising their signal level, which is noise to us. And before you know it, for a fixed audience, it can only get louder. It gets louder and louder until people are almost shouting. In some cases, if you go into a modern bar where the music, the background ambient music is so loud, they really are shouting. But it doesn't go in the other direction really until people start to leave.
I hate that. And of course, I don't go to bars. I don't drink. I'm not a drinker. So I have an aversion to bars in general, and particularly where they have either a jukebox going full blast or a band going full blast, and you can't have an enjoyable, quiet dinner conversation. You can't do it.
I agree fully. Last time I was at a place that had a band, or was a friend of mine came, this is 15, 20 years ago, wanted to go to Sunset Boulevard, wanted to go to the Whiskey A Go-Go where the Doors started out. And we went there like 1 or 2 in the morning, and everybody's wearing black leather jackets, and the music was so loud. I think terrible, too, but it's just my
right.
case. This heavy metal music. And I remember one woman in a black leather jacket was holding her little baby in the midst of that. I was just thinking about that, all that shockwave energy going into that young brain.
There are some technologies that allow you to put on some headphones. You know, they're advertised widely on TV.
Yes, they are.
That cancel noise, whether it's aircraft noise or, I don't know, a lot of background talking and yelling in bands or whatever. How well do they work?
They work well if the background noise doesn't change too fast. I have a class where we teach this. It's called Adaptive Signal Processing, and I discuss this in Chapter 5 of the book. It's based on something called LMS, or the least mean square algorithm. And as long as you can take a measurement and get a reference measurement of what the noise is, then you can build a model to add in the negative. And so it's in effect.
In other words, cancel it.
Which cancel, exactly. So you can have waves, one wave, the peak comes in at the trough of the other. If you do a lot of that, though, there's still a background hum. So on an airplane, it's very effective because you get a good sense of the changes in the engine noise. In a helicopter, it's tougher. I had a student did a project on that recently. And there's so many different kinds of rotor noise and other noise, and the helicopter is more difficult.
Right.
Had other students go to the Harbor Freeway, which is right next to USC, stand over it on a bridge and take measurements during rush hour. And the bulk of the noise you can cancel. It'll again have this humming sound, but when there's an impulse of noise, a car honking or something else making a lot of noise, an engine backfiring, that you can't cancel, and it'll come through.
You can't cancel it because the processor can't get a hold of it quick enough
to
cancel
it.
Add it
in to kill it off. It really comes down to signal plus noise minus noise. And if your estimate of that noise is good enough, you know, it literally kills it off as subtraction mathematically. But the trouble is it won't be good enough for a quick impulse. Like all of a sudden someone, which could happen around Los Angeles, a gunfire, shooting a gun. You won't be able to do that. Now, if you had an overall pattern of gunfire, you could probably develop some smart techniques. But the
God, I don't know. I hope we don't have to get to that.
I hope so as well. But for the kinds of sounds you would hear while driving, to cancel the hum in your car, or a variety of other things, I think it's worth getting. And contrary-wise, I would recommend against a headset used to amplify sound. The evidence just continues to mount that that's very dangerous. It produces hearing loss, and you don't realize that until it's too late.
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure I've got some hearing loss. I've been wearing headphones, Bart, all my adult life in radio, of course. So
you get that from the headphones. You get it from aging at a certain amount. But the latest studies, I cite a JAMA study, the Journal of American Medical Association, from almost 10 years ago, found that 15% of teenagers then, it's got to be higher now, have hearing loss comparable to old folks.
Really?
Yeah, just been blasting so much energy directly into the ear canal. That was long before the iPod.
Well, let me ask this. Is American society getting louder?
Yes, in almost every measure. There are some cases where it's not. For example, airplanes are quieter than they used to be. There's a lot of litigation about that. They're about as half as noisy as they were, say, in the 1960s and 70s. On the other hand, there's more of them. So that's a trade-off.
Sure.
There have been cases like that where there's been real efforts to improve soundproofing or the sound industrial sounds. But what is louder and harder to measure, Art, is what you talked about, just everybody in their daily life using more cell phones, more gadgets. There's you know, millions of car alarms, there's millions of leaf blowers, and things like that, which are only increasing in frequency and, again, in power. So it is noisier on net.
All right. Interestingly, right now, you and I have, and I don't know that the average person can hear it, but there's a little bit of hum on the line. Can you hear that?
I do, yes.
Okay. I think that's probably on your phone, Bart.
And it's probably from a power source.
From some sort of power source,
and
yes.
That's, by the way, a classic thing to noise cancel.
It would be. Yes, it would be. Unfortunately, in the radio business, you know, we've got a lot of devices that take background noise and amplify it.
Right.
And so it's probably, in some cases, getting amplified and quite loud. Other stations have a lot of dynamic range, and they might just hear it at a very low level. But it's there, and so it's noise. You say noise. Noise is become a legal nuisance. In other words, we're beginning to get legislation about noise.
Yeah, lots of legislation about noise. It really started about 80 years ago with zoning statutes, and of all things, piggeries. As urban centers started colliding with farms and the like, the smell of pigs, the sound of pigs, there's a lot of case law about that.
Right.
And over time, I think the economist's argument won, saying, look, it's just too difficult, Art, to litigate each case of a noise violation of a private nuisance. Right up to today, when someone's playing a boombox or speaking loudly into a cell phone, it's a lot easier to have an overall rule, whether it's put out by the government or your employer or simply recommended by a friend. That has been codified. There are federal rules. There's OSHA rules for heavy industry-type things and a variety of other things. But increasingly in cities, most cities have noise ordinances and technically decibel level measurements that you're not supposed to go beyond, but they're not heavily enforced.
No, you still see a lot of cars. I was in Las Vegas the other day for a doctor's appointment. And why is it that people feel it's so cool to remove a muffler? It's a small thing, but it's not so small. I mean, a car without a muffler is very, very noisy.
Yes, it is. Yeah, this is the problem. The economic structure of noise is a market failure. Somebody's getting a benefit. The person who removed that muffler is getting whatever benefit they get from that. But they're imposing all these costs on third parties and not having to pay for it. And that's not economically efficient. And that argues, whether we like it or not, but we don't, but it really does argue for some kind of coercion, some kind of government action. And that's the basis of noise ordinances, whether they're muffler rules or something comparable.
Do you actually think that we might ban cell phones in public places?
You know, I think we might in places like libraries. And they certainly are banned on the airplane once you take off, but for kind of a questionable reason of whether that cell phone could interfere with the electronics.
I've always had high doubts about that.
Yeah, I do too. But I understand they don't want to take any chances with that. And beyond that, it's just hard to believe that could happen. For example, California is about to implement a law that Governor Schwarzenegger signed that said you can still have speak on a cell phone, a car, but you have to have both hands on the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And some cities and places have experimented with banning cell phones, but I don't think those politicians stay in office very long.
Well, I have other complaints. You're a bright guy, Bart. Cell phone technology, in my estimation, while on the one hand has progressed, it has regressed. In other words, we've gone from the relatively good analog connections we had,
correct,
fairly good analog connections, they could have been better, to really lousy, narrow, digital, I barely recognize the voice on the other end kind of connections.
Yeah.
And I'm waiting for the first company to come along and actually increase bandwidth on cell phones and provide a really good, old-fashioned, honest-to-God connection.
You know, Art, I think that will happen someday, but right now there's so much competition for carriers that it's gone just, as you know, the other direction. A lot of the kids we teach at USC in our graduate program in signal processing go out and get jobs. They're the ones who drop your calls. They're the ones, if you're in L.A., who go around with antenna devices measuring the current signal strengths, and they make decisions directly or algorithmically whether to add more bits, more juice to your channel or to cut you off. It is tightly constrained. You know, those companies, I think, have fairly thin profit margins. But over time, it should improve. But you're absolutely right. The quality isn't real great. I think, on the other hand, Art, other than folks like you have more experience in audio, I don't think there's a lot of consumer complaints about it.
Well, there ought to be.
There may be.
Doing a, you know, so many people have cell phones now, Bart, that I would say 70 or 80% of the calls we get on a talk show like this, when we go to open lines, are from cell phones.
That's right. You think about that, Art, all the different services available and how those manufacturers and providers had to cut those fees down to the bone. And many of them go under, and I think that's why you're not seeing the bandwidth you'd like to see.
I suppose, but, you know, I, for one, would be willing to pay extra
right.
for a good connection. And I really think, Bart, that a lot of people would.
Yeah, I think we'll get back to that premium service at some point, but I don't see it right now. Everything's headed towards the disposable, be more inexpensive, have more cell phones than ever. Again, cheaper cell phone service. On the other hand, you have to admit, Art, it's quite reasonable, the fee structure in cell phones now versus what it was, say, 5 years ago.
Yes.
So,
well, that's true. It's true. Have you done any study at all? We touched on it a moment ago. All of the aircraft people tell you, as soon as we start to take off, all the cell phones have got to be turned off. Now, they claim that there's a danger to the navigation equipment of the aircraft. Is that a bunch of baloney?
Yeah, I'm hesitant, both as a scientist and lawyer, to answer that definitively. Either way. It's the sort of thing I don't think anyone can answer definitively. There's always a risk of it, and it takes us to that concept of negative evidence. You would have to have a lot of evidence accumulate before you could say, no, there is no such chance. It's very difficult to prove a negative, especially in something like that. And given the sophistication of the devices, how you could burn out or confuse or potentially jam things, and on top of that, I guess now the added risk that you could, a clever programmer might be able to figure out a way to do something quasi-terror style to jam systems. You know, I don't think anyone can come out and say there's no such risk. I mean, there's a similar problem with, what do you tell people, is it safe to hold a cell phone to your ear, that close to your brain, for a long period of time?
Is it?
Well, again, both as a scientist and a lawyer, I have to dither here. The evidence, it has been a lot of studies. They're largely inconclusive.
Now that you're a lawyer, you're going to be harder to talk to.
Yeah, a little harder to talk to, but what the findings are, looking at the meta-studies, that is, studies that look at all the other studies, that it tends to go both ways, and everyone's waiting for more data to come in, with the exception, usually a recommendation, in case of children, because they have thinner skulls and because their brains are developing, it probably makes sense to hedge your bets and give them a headset tuned down and not have them spend a lot of time blasting radio frequency energy into their brains.
It must be a lot safer to get a Bluetooth device, put that on your ear, and put the cell phone on your hip, right?
I think that would be.
Are the cell phone manufacturers, I don't know why I'm asking a lawyer this, are the cell phone manufacturers doing honest-to-God studies about the possible danger to people's brains by holding the cell phone close?
They really have done studies, Art, and as have a lot of other people in industry and the government. This is a worldwide phenomenon. I think Europe probably done more, but there was an article not too long ago on IEEE Spectrum looking at the overall data, and it's that finding that so far we really can't say. There's no immediate cause for alarm, but it's that difficulty of trying to prove a negative. And if you see, you know, any experience with the legal products liability, the potential downside is enormous.
Listen, if 20 years from now they find that
asbestos.
Yeah. If 20 years from now they find that, oh, there's been all kinds of damage, early Alzheimer's, all kinds of problems popping up, you guys who are lawyers, you're going to have a field day.
That's all too true.
Huh. All right. Hold it right there, Bart. Tonight's subject is noise, although Bart is qualified to talk about all kinds of other things like, for example, heaven in a chip. But we're gonna cover noise, various kinds of noise, and that coming up, how you can noise-proof your home. And if there's one place that you want noise-proof and you want quiet solitude, it would be your home. We'll talk about it in a moment. Bart Costco is my guest, and we're talking about noise. It's actually a much more interesting topic than you might imagine. Noise is quite a study, and I wonder how it's affected your life. In a moment, we'll talk about how you can have a much less noisy home. We'll be right back. Interesting. I've got a couple of messages here. I've got hundreds. Somebody says they don't understand the topic of noise. Let's see. I'm not going to even give the name here. And Kent Washington says, happy birthday, Art. Costco's a genius, but I don't understand the noise discussion. Isn't sound noise what you make of it? I love all sorts of music and sounds, but others that would think is pure noise. I'd rather hear him talk about heaven on a chip. We'll do a little bit of that. Noise, folks, is an extremely important part of your environment for the good or the bad of it. And for those who are understanding what we're talking about, how does one go about minimizing the noise in your home, your castle, the one place you want it to be quiet?
Well, one thing, Art, is to replace tile floors with carpets. That may be the biggest thing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Corporations and other places, a lot of folks like tiles because it's easy to clean. But it just bounces the sound waves off and they ricochet around. You want something that absorbs the vibrations of sound.
That's right.
And again, noise is, in this case, unwanted sound, unwanted energy. You can also put up drapes. It goes a long way. But the carpets are a big deal here. And the old shag carpets of the 70s are probably the best way to go. They're harder to clean. They may be gaudy to look at, but they absorb sound much better. Likewise, appliances should be put on rubber mats or comparable structures to dissipate sounds.
That's a good point.
That does help to do that. There's other thing. If you take your windows, there's two ways to go. One is simply to caulk them. Caulking makes a big difference. It helps seal the sound waves coming in and helps damp down those vibrations because those windows are almost perfect vibrators.
Boy, is that a good idea.
Now, if you've got the money for it, you can come up with more elaborate windows that have a thermos-like structure. There's two windows, and there's some trapping the sound in between. That's expensive and requires a lot of remodeling. But the simplest thing to do is go to your hardware store and buy some caulking compound.
Oh, that's such a good idea. I'm going to do that.
You can try it. Just see what happens. In fact, you can go to a local electronics store and get a noise meter and just measure it, for example. You can see. By the way, it's a good thing to take with you or have in general. But those are simple things you can do.
Well, I live here in the desert, Bart, where heat is a big problem. Noise is not so much of a problem. It's very quiet here, but heat is. And I've got these special screens that kill a lot of the heat. But the caulking idea is not just only good for noise. It's also good for heat.
Absolutely. It's insulation.
Very good. That's just and then the idea of putting something rubber under the appliances is superb. I bet that really cuts it down.
Cuts it down, and I think it helps clean things ultimately and move things.
Yeah, washers, dryers, refrigerators, that sort of thing.
Yes.
I'm going to do that. Thank you very much. What a wonderful idea.
You're welcome.
Okay, have you done that in your own home?
I've done some of that and always doing more of it. But I put up a lot of layers on the windows to block out sound and light. I think you also sleep better that way. And I go further. I like to sleep with a fan. I like to approximate that white noise sound of a stream or fountain. That
you mm-hmm.
And when it goes off, you know, they're much more likely to hear the other sounds. But it tends to mask sounds. One of the big health problems with noise is lack of sleep or lower quality sleep. And
yes.
Another symptom of modern society.
What is white noise, Bart?
White noise is, it doesn't technically exist, though we act like it does in science. White noise is noise where each hiss and pop in the noise, if you were to slow it down and play it, is completely independent of the one before it. Just as if somebody were flipping a coin, and whether it comes up heads or tails is independent of the previous flip.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, there's a little bit of correlation. And nothing's perfect. And if there's a little bit of correlation between each hiss and pop, then we usually call that pink noise. But if you were to put on sci-fi glasses and look at the spectrum of white noise, it'd be flat across a constant energy level across all the frequencies. Pink noise would kind of gently roll off. Your ear actually hears it as white noise. And more correlated noise, which has created all kinds of real thermal processes around you and in you, that we call brown noise. And even more correlated noise is often called black noise. So there's a whole spectrum of colors in the analogy with visible light.
Hmm. Okay, here is an example of what I think white noise is here. That sound like white noise?
That's a pretty good approximation.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you look at its spectrum, it'd be approximately flat.
Yeah, that's just taking a VHF radio with no signal, removing the squelch, and that's basically, that's almost white noise.
That's right. You know, a lot of electronic devices produce a kind of pink noise, crackle noise, popcorn noise. There's all kind of, in the book I talk about 40 different kinds in one section, but most attempts to add noise to a system that we use just what you did, something electronic or otherwise to generate that, to approximate that. It's used in a variety of ways to boost the energy of the signal, to hide things in the background, to mask it, and in some cases, even, as I discuss in the book, to use it as a way to code. I mean, that's in effect what's going on a lot of those cell phones. All those signals are crossing in the air, and it's as if there's background noise. One analogy I heard once, I think, does this very effectively. If you're using what's called CDMA in your phone, code division multiple access, it's as if you're in a room and several people are talking, and each of the two people talking are speaking in a different foreign language. So you can understand each other, but all the other talking sounds like soft background noise. Now,
that's right.
As opposed to putting each person in a separate room, which would be a frequency division multiplexing, the older way, or to say two people speak at a time, you go, then you go, then you go, that would be time division multiplexing, another older way. So it is a way of using, letting all this crosstalk interference create a kind of faint background noise.
Okay. And you say that some white noise, kind of like, for example, a soft fan above you at night, is actually helps?
It certainly helps threshold-like systems, thresholds like neurons that are on-off switches. And your brain consists of a few hundred billion of those, and also throughout your body. That's a mathematical fact, something we call the forbidden interval theorem. You can prove that it'll occur. A lot of simulations have shown it. There's a variety of scientists have demonstrated with different kinds of life forms. There's never been a demonstration of an internal noise source in a creature affecting other parts of the body and improving it. But we have been able to take, we being my colleague, noise and add it to a system and improve the overall performance of the system. So it does it. That's called SR, or stochastic resonance.
You broke up there.
I'm sorry. It's called stochastic resonance, or SR.
Okay. All right. You're now a lawyer. Are you going to use your law degree in this area anywhere?
You know, Art, my law degree is something I use largely for scholarly purposes. For example, working with the law school to set up a course on statistics and other types of uncertainty, I want to help bridge scientists on the one hand and lawyers and judges on the other. Scientists need to learn a lot more about the law, especially intellectual property. And my experience that lawyers and judges need a great deal more about law. And so it's more along those lines, an occasional incidental practice. And I did work, as you said at the outset, for the district attorney.
Yes. It says you worked recently as a bar-certified law clerk for the L.A. District Attorney's Office. What do you do?
Well, I prosecuted felony preliminary hearings. And it was, for an academe like me, about as close as I'll ever get to combat, I think. I wanted something with action. The help of some judges and others, I got the position. I had to be trained, and initially I participated in various prosecutions. And then, with a supervisor, I was able to go solo. And
wow.
So this is the screening device, the little mini trial that we have in California for a felony, not a misdemeanor. Grand theft auto, for example, certain kinds of drug possession or selling, a lot of violent things. And quite often the defendant is held to answer, and the case proceeds. And if there's not a strong enough case, and then it's kicked out at that level. But a great majority of the cases, felonies, are dealt with at the level of the what's called the prelim, the preliminary hearing. Very few actually go all the way to trial. I mean, I don't know, maybe 3% or something.
Well, since you're now a lawyer and you worked in a prosecutor's office, do you have any advice for people who get in trouble with the law?
Two things. Number one, I would keep my mouth shut. And number two, I would call an attorney. In fact, what I recommend that people do, and I'm not trying to plug for legal services, but if you don't have an attorney, and I don't think most people do, you can go to your Yellow Pages or other device and tear out the page. I can't advise you to photocopy it. Tear out the page, assuming you own the book, of a good criminal defense lawyer, for example, and fold that up and put it in your wallet. But, Art, if somebody with a badge says you have the right to remain silent, do listen to them.
Well, I watch Law & Order. It's one of my favorite shows. And the moment the attorney walks in the room in the middle of some sort of interrogation, first thing they say is, interview's over, shut up.
And that's right. My experience at the DA's office, and I witnessed a lot of prosecutions, and I read hundreds of files and others, is that usually the defendant hangs his or herself, usually himself, in that process of interrogation. Quite often, look, the fact is, unlike TV, criminals often are not the sharpest tools in the shed, and they're often drunk, and it isn't clear why they're doing these things. They're drunk or drugged up. In the heat of passion, they say all kinds of incriminating things. I remember one case involving some local gangsters. There was a fight in the parking lot, and the girl bit the fellow on the arm, and he was so mad about that he just kind of fessed up to everything. It was a big drug deal going on. And he thought that the DA would prosecute the girl for the bite. Well, they never did. The prosecutor has full discretion, but his admissions at that time sent him to prison.
Fascinating. I've always wondered why it is legal in the process of an interrogation, after the subject has been Mirandized and so forth, for the police to lie to the person being interrogated. I mean, you know, saying things like, well, your buddy Johnny in the other interrogation room just gave you up, so you might as well go ahead and tell us the story.
You know, if you use the verb lie, I think the legal system would say that's not permissible, but the fact is, most police departments in major cities the policemen are trained on how to conduct interrogations. They really push it to the limit on rules like Miranda and related decisions. I don't know if they lie, but they, put it this way, the Miranda rights are not nearly as powerful as you think they are. And by the way, almost all studies show that defendants will simply waive them. Outside of TV, you don't see them carrying a lot of weight. But the key thing behind Miranda and that kind of 1950s stuff it came out of, where the police would give the third degree, is that there'd be no coercion. And so once you've been notified that you have a right to the attorney, been fully Mirandized, and you proceed with the interrogation, the nature of the questioning can be quite broad. Now, before that, it's very different.
Well, people are very easily intimidated. In other words, for example, once you request an attorney, at that point, they are, if television is correct, which it frequently is not, they have to stop and get you an attorney, don't they?
Well, almost. And that's
almost
the Edwards rule. And television is largely accurate here, that this is the one case, unlike the right to silence, where the police have the right to come back and reinitiate the interrogation. If you unequivocally, I stress that adverb there, unequivocally say, I want my attorney or I want a attorney, then all questioning must cease. To go beyond that would be unconstitutional. But you have to make that crystal clear. It wouldn't be like, hey, wouldn't it be neat if I had an attorney? That won't do. You have to state it quite clearly. Whether they have to go get the attorney for you is different, but does start a process, and any further questioning is forbidden.
Well, on the other hand, so you're saying that you should do that, keep your mouth shut, get an attorney, even if you're innocent as new driven snow, you can still get yourself in trouble. Or if you're really innocent, is it okay to say, look, no, I'll talk to you. What do you want to know? I didn't do a thing, so let's
my
talk.
My main advice on anything where your life or liberty or property could be at risk is to get an attorney immediately on anything, but specifically on criminal law matters. I'm certainly not advising people how to evade the law. I hope the cops win the majority of cases here. But I do think it's a case that even an innocent person or bystander, someone could snap a trap on themselves, or at least create a lot of hassles in life they don't need. The first order, it's a very complex legal proceeding that started there. And even if you are a lawyer, you still need another lawyer who's objective and can help you with the process.
Bart, let me ask you about this. You know, we're drifting sideways here, but that's all right. Last week, there was a lead story on the Associated Press News about the death penalty.
Yeah.
And I've always been a very, very, very staunch advocate of the death penalty. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these exoneration groups have begun to sort of rock my conviction, sorry for that term, that word, about the death penalty, because too many people on death row lately have been released because of new evidence, specifically DNA evidence. And these are people who are going to get the needle or worse and get put to death, and suddenly they didn't do it.
That's right. Whatever your position is on the death penalty, that it is unique, the punishment in that case, it's irreversible, really unlike anything else.
Right.
The frequency of the false positives, that's up to debate, but it is fairly high. One problem, Art, is I don't think there's enough, in the nature of government proceedings, enough yet computerization of and checks of the DNA involved. This can take a long time. I was involved in one case at the DA's office where all of a sudden a felon was brought in out of, I think, Chino prison because many years earlier he had left his DNA at a rape and beating site.
Hmm.
And it had taken that long, and the investigating officer had the foresight simply to cut out a chunk of the carpet
mm-hmm.
that contained his substances. And it took a long time for that to work its way to the criminal justice system until they got it, did the positive ID. But given that, and we are talking about the government here, it's not the most efficient of enterprises, I think it should give everyone cause for pause.
It's beginning to affect me. I'm not so sure anymore that such a final punishment is appropriate when we're finding so many innocent people.
On the other hand, if you have a case where the guilt is indisputable, the classic extreme philosophy class example is, what do you do with Hitler? If you really are opposed to the death penalty, would you just give him life? That's an extreme case. But there are many cases, dictators and recently Saddam Hussein, where there was no doubt that these were mass murderers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different matter. But for the rank-and-file person sitting on death row, there is a real issue there of the criminal evidence.
Here's another question. Maybe you can comment. In some instances, now Texas carries out death penalties pretty quickly compared to other states, and there have been a few instances where DNA exonerated the person on death row, but even in the face of that, the legal system proceeded with the execution based on the fact that, look, we don't care about the new evidence. This person was adjudged guilty by, jury of their peers, and this execution is going to go forth.
Sometimes you'll see decisions in the Supreme Court and elsewhere where there seems to be an undue adherence to meeting a filing deadline. I think that's what happened in the case you're referring to. It's been a while since I looked at it. One of the hard lines in the law is the filing of an appeal, and that's not a fuzzy line at all. It's an absolute black-white line. If you miss that at any step in the proceedings, they can have draconian consequences.
Wow.
Now, on the other hand, judges are supposed to resort to what's called equity and to deal with hardships like that, and that's where the debate lies now.
Mm-hmm. Now that you're an attorney, is there any itch in you to practice criminal law, either side? You've done a little on one side. What about the other?
Not in a general way, Art. I work with USC where I chair the Intellectual Property Committee. That's really my emphasis is IP, patents, which I hope we can talk about tonight. The big changes in patent law that are taking place this summer.
Really?
But patents and copyrights and trademark and trade secret and all the stuff that really underlies modern society and technology. And a little more the theory of evidence, which is getting what you were just talking about. What counts as evidence one way or the other? When in particular can you use statistics? I teach statistics. I just finished a class in it. And there was a famous Supreme Court case that came down 5-4, and it had to do whether the defendant could prove discrimination. He was black and in Georgia had killed a white policeman.
Mm.
And the statistics showed that it was overwhelmingly likely if you were black and killed a white that you would get the death penalty versus the other way around. And it came down 5-4. That remains the most famous statistical study in the law to date.
All right, Bart, hold it right there. Bart Costco is my guest. I'm Art Bell.